In case you're not familiar with Porgy and Bess, it is a folk opera about a disabled street beggar, Porgy, who's living in the slums of Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. It's about his attempts to rescue Bess from the clutches of her violent and possessive lover, the drug dealer whose name is Sportin' Life. Mm-hmm. And Gershwin's music clearly incorporates jazz, draws on southern black traditions, jubilees, mm-hmm. praying songs, mm-hmm. street cries, work songs, spirituals. And these are blended with arias and recitatives and leitmotifs, if you will, from European opera tradition. The opera contains some of his most famous and beloved and recognizable melodies like Summertime, okay. I Got Plenty of Nothing, It Ain't Necessarily So. Mm-hmm. And like Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, Gershwin claimed that everything he composed in it was original. So on paper, it looks like Gershwin took to heart Dvorak's advice. Do you agree, Marvin, or is there a dark side to this piece when it comes to its connection with Dvorak's legacy?
There is a dark side to Porgy and Bess that is more known now than I think it was when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Porgy and Bess was a vehicle for black people to be in opera. And if you saw in the score, mm-hmm. Gershwin's very clear that this is to be done by black
Only by black singers.
But it's also a drug dealing story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my issues is it became the only vehicle for black folks to be in opera.
Yeah.
And that has been one of my issues, is that why can't we sing Aida, which Leading Price did.
Of course, right. Mm-hmm.
But it took all these years before Marian Anderson got on the stage of the Met. So what you present is almost like the minstrel show in some ways.
Mm.
The minstrel show was created to show black people in a bad light and make fun of them.
Right.
You create an opera, and Gershwin, created some wonderful music, but it's a story about poor black people who can't do any better.
Mm.
And so how often do we have to hear that?
Right.
Now, on the other end of it, Porgy and Bess has made fortunes for a lot of black singers.
Right.
And has given them their career starts.
Mm-hmm.
And we all love Summertime. We all love I Got Plenty of Nothing. Ain't Necessarily So. I've done the concert version when I was younger, not realizing, I think that as I got older and began to do my more study, began to look at why has this been the only vehicle?
Mm.
When you hear Porgy and Bess, and I went to the performance at the Met when they came back out, and I loved it, but I kept thinking this is a story about a woman that can't contain her cocaine mm-hmm. addiction, and this guy who loves her but follows her, and Sportin' Life, who's a very evil man, but also the poverty of Charleston. So on another end of it, it shows what people were going through at the same time.
Right.
The fact that the opening scene when the guy dies, mm-hmm. they have to keep up with this money or else his body's going to be taken to be cut up.
Right.
And the wife is just hysterical mm-hmm. about this. And I don't blame her.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing also the racist part of what Charleston was.
Yeah.
And how that played into American life as well. So while I think it's a wonderful piece of Americana, until recently, with Terrence Blanchard's new operas,
right.
which I've seen both of them now, mm-hmm. Fresh Up in My Bones and Champion,
mm-hmm.
Wonderful pieces of music,
yep.
fabulous pieces of music. We've been stuck as black folks in this one area.
Mm.
They assume you can sing Summertime. They assume you can sing Porgy and Bess. But if you want to sing Carmen, they have a heart attack because
right.
how dare you venture out of your comfort zone? You're supposed to be in this area. And that's maybe a little cynical on one end, but in today's world, as you look at it, it's the image.
Right.
And the image that George Gershwin and his brother created
mm-hmm.
was they took a group of people imagined out of Charleston, created this scenario for this book, and said the music. And it became a vehicle to get black folks into opera.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only vehicle for so long.
Right. I'm so glad you mentioned Terrence Blanchard's two recent operas. I've seen them as well. These are phenomenal and wonderful steps in the right direction, which we continue we need to continue to go.
So Terence has taken Dvorak's prophecy.
Yes, indeed.
In a different direction. And I think the audiences have gravitated towards that. Five Shove in My Bones just came back to the Met last week.
Right.
It was back on wow. One of my friends was in it. And I saw Champion when it was here in Chicago. Yeah. Tears in my eyes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Powerful story.
Yeah.
You know? But I think, so Porgy and Bess has its place. But it cannot be the only vehicle for African Americans to be on the stage in opera.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think it works as inclusion in our concert.
Copeland did not particularly care for this opera for Porgy and Bess. Many of the critics didn't care for it, but it has become a mainstay in an American culture now.
It has. I mean, I remember growing up, I wore out Canadian Brass, their CD, when they were playing music of Gershwin and featuring a major segment of from Porgy and Bess. I didn't know the lyrics at that stage. I just knew this fantastic melody, these rhythms, and sort of play along in my head the trumpet parts. So that's how I first learned this music, purely aesthetically, not knowing about its background. And I still love it to this day on a musical level. Let's move to our next piece, which is by today's foremost Native American composer, Jared Impechachaha Tate. Jared is an American Indian classical composer and pianist whose music is uniquely inspired with Native American melodies, rhythms, culture, and history. He's been commissioned by major U.S. orchestras, and his music has been performed all over the world. He's a member of the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma, and we're going to be performing a piece of his called Chokefee, which is the Chickasaw name for rabbit. Chokefee is an important trickster within Southeast American Indian cultures, and at the beginning, it features the percussion. Jared goes on to quote a beautiful and popular tribal church hymn in honor of his Muscogee Creek friends. Let's hear that. That is just so beautiful. You know, we played a piece of Jared's at our annual gala last August. Well, I know you know that. You were there. And I recommend that all of our listeners check out more of his music, which you can find on his website, jaredtate.com.
I was going to mention, you talked about the rabbit and the trickster. And trickster tales are part of African traditions as well.
Oh, fantastic.
We have the signifying monkey is one of ours. Trickster tales were significant in these cultures because the idea of the trickster tale was a small animal could outwit a large animal.
Yeah.
And so in the tradition of Africa, these were taught to kids. that just because you were 6 feet tall and weighed 300 pounds didn't mean that you had any smarts. That the spider, Anansi the spider, was one of those animals. The rabbit, it was the smaller animal, could outwit. So just because you were big didn't mean that you had any brains. And the fact that he uses the rabbit again, and the trickster thing, I think is sort of, it carries over into both cultures. And in a lot of cultures, there's this trickster animal. And there's a whole array of African and African-American folktales where the small animal outwits the lion and the elephant and all those kind of things. So the trickster tales are very important and were used to teach kids about critical thinking.
Thanks for sharing that. It's fascinating. We're going to end our first half with music by Florence Price. Marvin, what can you tell us about her and her connection to Dvorak's legacy?
Well, Florence Price was a unique woman in that she was raised in Arkansas, graduated from high school at 14.
Wow.
As valedictorian of her class. Went to conservatory of music in the conservatory of music. Recently, I just discovered that because of her color, she tried to pass herself off as Hispanic. Because African-Americans were looked down upon. But she was the first African-American woman to have a piece performed by the Chicago Symphony.
Right.
Before William Grant Still. And her piece, Symphony in E minor, won the prize and was performed in the summertime. I think it was 1932 or 33. But Florence, when she finished school, returned to Arkansas and unfortunately had an abusive marriage. And she and her children left Arkansas, ended up in Chicago, and ended up at the home of Margaret Bonds. And he was this woman who had this great talent and was a theater organist for a while and all these things before she got to be where she was. She had an encounter with conductors to get her music done. And one of the heartbreaking stories was that she wrote to Sergei Koussevitzky, the Boston Symphony. And in her letter to him with her music, she said, "I have two things against me. I'm black and I'm a woman." He never responded either of her letters. Women composers, as we know, weren't valued. And being a black woman composer was even worse.
Right.
She created a whole bunch of stuff and was somewhat well-known at the time, but then she passed away. And we know her from a few pieces that everybody knows, particularly her arrangements of spirituals for voice. And it was in, I think it was 2018 or 17, they had discovered her summer house outside of Chicago. And the summer house was all this music. And all of a sudden we have all this music by Florence Price now. And in your first concert of Dvorak's legacy, Michelle Kahn did the piano concerto, which was unbelievable. And nobody knew it existed. And so her legacy is now being more and more being showcased. People are doing Florence Price festivals all over the place because she wrote so prolifically, but again, couldn't get her music performed by orchestras. And that's the tragedy of Dvorak's prophecy. He says to use this music, but because of the racial problems we've had in this country, it's been set aside. So as a student of music myself, I didn't hear very much about Florence Price. Well, I did any of my education. The only black composer we ever talked about briefly was William Grant Still. And now the whole world's opening up.
Sure is.
And Michelle performed the Philadelphia Orchestra did the concerto, won a Grammy for it. Michelle's playing it everywhere. Different people are playing it. And people are playing more and more of her music. A couple of years ago, before you arrived, when Sujay was conducting, we did a concert on African Americans in South Bend, and I gave him the Mississippi River Suite of hers. And he said to me, "Where did you find this gem?" And I thought, "It's been around for a while." But if you don't study it, then you don't know about it. And I will commend you on the fact that you have after our very first conversation, you did your homework. And I think, and a shout out to the South Bend Symphony Orchestra under your leadership, that it has changed the repertoire to include, be more inclusive.
It's part of our mission.
Yeah, it is. It should be part of all symphonies' missions.
Amen.
As we know, it doesn't happen like that.
Right.
So, and people, when they came to the first concert, came up to me and said, wow, this is great stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Absolutely.
But I've known it for a long time, but nobody else knew about it. Mm-hmm. And so having it played more often.
Yeah.
You did William Dawson's Necro Folk Symphony. Mm-hmm. You did the young man.
Quinn Mason.
And you did Florence Price. And I remember you sitting on the stage and you said to the orchestra, how many of you have ever played any of this music?
Right.
Two people raised their hand.
Right.
Which tells you the canon of music needs to be changed. And Dvorak set a standard for the canon.
Yeah.
Use the music of your people.
Mm-hmm.
But America didn't see the canon, the music of African Americans or Native Americans as worthy.